So in 2015, we took a position that we wanted to be 100% renewable in how we operate our business globally. And then that manifested about 4 or 5 years later when we then made a commitment to the Paris-based climate accords.
That's the Managing Director of Equinix Australia, Guy Danskin, being interviewed on the ABC podcast, Who's Gonna Save Us? Welcome. This is the latest episode of Climate Conversations. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. And I pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And I forget this almost every time. I am your host, Robert McLean. First, we'll hear a little more from that podcast, for which you'll find the link in the show notes.
We have 240 data centres today around the world, and we're committed that we would run all of those on renewable energy by 2030. So, substantial commitment.
They're ambitious targets.
That's our executive producer, Joel Werner, who interviewed Guy earlier this year.
So let's talk about now, 7 years later, 2022 in Australia. Like, of the energy use that Equinix Australia puts into its data centres and its infrastructure, how much today is being powered by renewable energy?
Yeah, so we don't break out renewable energy by country. I'd just say that globally, we, as of last year, we were 95% renewable, so we're getting close.
Equinix are quick to talk about their global achievements, and at that scale, the work the company's doing to switch to renewable energy is impressive. But the thing is, with a bit of digging, you can break out their renewable energy use by country, which is exactly what Joel did. And when you do it, it doesn't look so good for Equinix Australia.
On the sustainability section of your website, though, it does break it down by country. So there's a line in the review where it's like, in 2021, Equinix had data center operations in 27 countries and purchased renewable energy in every country except Australia. So has Australia been a bit slow to uptake renewable energy? And are there issues with how the renewable energy sector works in Australia that kind of make it more difficult to operate here?
Yeah, there's a bit there. Look, Australia, if we're being candid, has been a laggard in terms of regulatory and governance processes for renewable energy, and I would just say that's from successive governments.
This was an episode of Who's Gonna Save Us, in which I had a particular interest, as several years ago I sat in a University of Melbourne auditorium and listened as a professor who was one of Australia's leading climate scientists at the time and still is, tell us that the digital world had a huge carbon footprint. And he said it was something we needed to think seriously about. Sadly, I can't remember the exact number, but it was frighteningly high. Now we shift to The Insider, where we find a story by Freya Graham, and that story is headlined, Four Ways to Pay for the Climate Crisis, according to Al Gore and other leaders at Davos. The story begins, there was a financing gap in our climate pledges, and we need to find a way to fill it quickly. That's the warning from panellists at the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland this week. In his welcoming remarks, World Economic Forum founder Klaus Schwab said, the world is currently confronted with unprecedented and multiple challenges. If the expert sessions held on Tuesday morning are anything to go by, the most pressing of these challenges is financing the climate crisis. John Kerry, US Special Presidential Envoy for Climate, opened the proceedings with an at times gloomy outlook. We're not doing everything we promised, he said. I'm convinced that we will get to a low carbon economy. I'm not convinced we're going to get there in time. Next, we read a story from the Los Angeles Times, and the headline for that story is, California faces catastrophic flood dangers and a need to invest billions in protection. The story by Ian James begins. The storms have been battering California offer a glimpse of the catastrophic floods that scientists warn will come in the future, and the state is unprepared to endure. Giant floods like those that inundated the Central Valley in 1861 and 1862 are part of California's natural cycle, but the latest science shows that the coming mega floods, intensified by climate change, will be much bigger and more destructive than anything the state or county has ever seen. A new state flood protection plan for the Central Valley presents a stark picture of the dangers. It says catastrophic flooding could threaten millions of Californians, putting many areas underwater and causing death and destruction on an unprecedented scale. The damage could total as much as $1 trillion. Now from the New Daily we hear, NASA and Boeing joined forces to develop airliner of the future. The story by reporter George Hyde begins. NASA and Boeing have teamed up to deliver the airliner of the future in a move aviation experts say is a significant global development. NASA advanced on Wednesday that it will work with Boeing on the Sustainable Flight Demonstrator Project, which seeks to build, test and fly an emissions-reducing single-aisle aircraft this decade. Now we shift to the conversation, where we have a story that has the headline, What Do Oranges, Coffee Grounds and Seaweed Have in Common? They outshine cotton in sustainable fashion. The story begins. Ever considered the carbon footprint of manufacturing your favourite shirt? The average cotton shirt produces 2.1 kilograms of carbon dioxide, but a polyester shirt produces over twice as much, 5.5 kilograms. It might come as no surprise that the fashion industry is responsible for around 5% of global CO2 emissions. Some natural fibres can also take a heavy toll on the environment. Last week, for example, an ABC investigation revealed hundreds of hectares of the Northern Territory's pristine tropical savanna had been cleared to make way for cotton farms, sometimes without permit. So, are there more sustainable textiles we should be producing or purchasing instead? The story is by Rakenshaw Hayak, Associate Professor at the RMIT University in Vietnam. Now from The Guardian we hear, in a story written by Anne Davies, is it time to turn Western Sydney into a city of fountains? It might help beat the heat. The secret to more livable, cooler Australian cities may lie with the ancient Romans and a network of fountains like the Trevi and those in the Piazza Navona, a new report on tackling urban heat has found. Rome has a network of 2,000 fountains which draw huge crowds daily to enjoy the cooling effects in the dense city. City planners should take note, says the president of the Western Sydney Regional Organisation of Councils, Barry Calvert. Now we shift to WA Today, where we find a story by Jacinta Burton. The headline for that story is, Continuation of His Legacy, McCubbin Descendant, Lords Woodside Protesters. The great-great-grandchild of Australian artist Frederick McCubbin has lauded the protesters who allegedly defaced without actually damaging his century-old painting with the Woodside's logo, hailing it a spiritual continuation of his legacy. Two activists donning Disrupt Barup Hub t-shirts allegedly converged on the Art Gallery of WA on Thursday, with footage showing a woman branding the perspex covering McCubbin's 1889 painting down on his luck with the energy giant's trademark before gluing her hand to the wall. Now we read a story by Giles Parkinson on Renew Economy. It's headlined, Australia's biggest wind turbine erected at what will be the largest wind farm in New South Wales. The story by Parkinson begins, the first 6-megawatt wind turbine in Australia, the largest in the country to date, has been installed at what will be the biggest wind farm in the state of New South Wales. The Vertas V162 6.0 megawatt machine has a tip height of 200 metres and is the first of 66 such machines to be installed at the 396 megawatt Rye Park wind farm north of Yass. This first turbine was erected on January 19, some 12 months after the start of construction. The Rye Park wind project is being built by Tilt Renewables and is supported by a foundation offtake agreement with Newcrest Mining and Cadia Gold and Copper Mine near Orange. Tilt says, so far 38 of the 66 wind turbine foundations have been poured and delivery of the wind turbine components are ongoing, although progress has been hampered by bad weather in 2022. About 250 people are employed in the construction phase. Let's move now to ABC News, where we find a story written by Rachel Clayton. It has the headline, "Solar panels are leading the clean energy revolution, but recycling them isn't easy." Clayton's story begins, "Just as one truck leaves, another rolls in." Almost every day, Anthony Vibbon's solar recycling plant in Melbourne's north receives dozens of used solar panels. In the car park, multiple tilting towers of the devices, held together by tie-downs, take up the spaces. Right now, a lot of them come from schools as the state government upgrades or replaces about 500 solar panel systems. Others come from businesses, homes or solar farms from rural Victoria. Join me now to read a story from The Guardian by environment editor Damien Carrington. The story is headlined, "Super Tipping Points Could Trigger Cascade of Climate Action." Carrington's story begins, "Three super tipping points for climate action could trigger a cascade of decarbonisation across the global economy, according to a report. Relatively small policy interventions on electric cars, plant-based alternatives to meat and green fertilisers could lead to unstoppable growth in those sectors. But the boost this would give battery and hydrogen production would mean crucial knock-on benefits for other sectors, including energy storage and aviation. Urgent emissions cuts are needed to avoid irreversible climate breakdown, and the experts say the super tipping points are the fastest way to drive global action, offering plausible hope that a rapid transition to green economy can happen in time." Now we spot a story in the Melbourne Age, and it's by Patrick Hatch and Nick Toscano. The story has the headline, "Everyone Wants a Piece. Are Electric Vehicles Australia's Opportunity of a Lifetime?" Paragraph under the headline says, "Australia's wealth of key minerals puts it in a unique position as the electric vehicle revolution gains speed. But time is running out to seize a far greater part of the value chain, such as making battery cells or even cars of the future." The story begins, "On June 8, 2000, Australia's got a glimpse of a possible future for its automotive industry. It looked familiar enough, like a sleek remake of the best-selling Holden Commodore, as it drove towards Uluru, trailing the Olympic torch relay. But inside the iconic frame was something new to these shores, a hybrid powertrain, combining a four-cylinder engine with a 50-kilowatt electric motor. Holden and the CSIRO, which developed the electric motor, its supercapacitors and lead-acid batteries, said the Eco Commodore concept vehicle used half the petrol of a conventional model and produced dramatically lower emissions. It was clearly the way of the future. It was what we had to do," says Laurie Spark, who was Holden's head of innovation at the time and led the carmaker's two-year collaboration with the CSIRO. We've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. All those stories I've mentioned, you'll find links for them in the show notes. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And if you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share with your friends. And I encourage you to share with your friends, as we all need to know all we possibly can about the climate crisis. So until we talk again, please take care.